is still with us all these years later. So we'll talk about all of that. But tell us, Sarah, come on now, just tell us. The title of your book, To Be a Problem, is derived from W.E.B. Du Bois's book, The Souls of Black Folk. Why did you choose this title?
Well, thank you for that. That is it. Yeah, so the book is called To Be a Problem because W.E.B. Du Bois, when he was going through the South and discussing race and racism, Southerners said to him, how does it feel to be a problem? Whenever he's, you know, how does it feel your problem because you're talking about race? And the many years that I worked here in D.C., and I continue, unfortunately, to work and have to be in those spaces sometimes, whenever we have discussions about disability policy here in D.C., I was the only person of color in the room, and I would bring up race issues, and I would bring up sexual orientation issues, and I would bring up those issues they did not want to discuss, and I was always called the problem. I had one job where every Thursday morning they would call my boss and say, could you please get her to stop talking about race? You know, and he was like, you know, she is race. She's a black woman sitting in the room. And so, you know, I also journal, and I used to write things down, and I had written about this, and I read. I love W.E. Du Bois, and when it came time to, you know, when I was asked to do this book and put it together, when it came time for the title, I immediately knew, you know, I was like, this is what I want to be a problem, because this is what W.E. Du Bois was saying, and so that's where it came from. And if you get my book, please read the introduction. Many people skip over the introduction, but the introduction for this is laying the foundation for the entire book, and it explains to be a problem, and it weaves throughout the book.
And, of course, Sarah, you started being a problem as a child, right?
I mean, watch out.
You were working with your parents. You were a little disagreeable, were you not?
Uh-oh, yes, that's fourth grader. That's fourth grader now. Let's talk about that. Fourth grader.
Yes. Yeah, it's real interesting. This book is a memoir, and I didn't even know what a memoir was, right? It's a piece of your life, but you still have to talk about the foundation of your life. And yes, Daryl, you are correct. So a couple of things. I was raised in East Orange, Newark, New Jersey. And if you know us, we are a political city, town, county, Essex County. And so, you know, I was around, you know, people being out. My grandfather was one of those people who carried voter registration cards. We would go out to dinner, and he would walk through the room, and people say hi. And he'd say, you registered to vote. You know, so that's the kind of how I grew up. You know, he took the Sunday van and drove people to vote on election day. So I grew up in that. And I also grew up in my family was able to send me to a private school, Catholic school. I was one of the first black children to go there. And I had to fight for myself in that school and in that education. And so, yeah, I was a problem there. You know, I had so-called Christian women who were teaching me who didn't want to talk to me, who ignored me, who treated me poorly. And my parents taught me to be able to say things to them and say, this is wrong, and then go to my parents and get their support. And so, yeah, it's been a part of my life, all my life. And to watch my mother, who was a union person and a very well-respected in her union, she was an educator in Newark, became a teacher, then became an ESL instructor, then became a principal. So, you know, I've been on the, you know, been out there with my mom doing those things, you doing strikes, marching, organizing. And so I just grew up with that, and it's been a part of my life.
Wow. And tell our listeners, because they're just listening, and they're going, to be a problem. If you're listening right now, everybody, put your hand up if you've been told you're a problem for, you know, raising issues of relating to black folks and our, you know, issues that we want people to deal with. So tell us, what are the main themes of your book? Because there's several. There's a lot. Tell people, what are the main themes of your book?
Yeah, sure. So exactly what I said, it's a memoir to talk about a little bit about my life and how I came to be where I am. It's also discussing the way in which the disability rights community truly ignores any other community other than white community. It is the reason disability justice was created. And this happens throughout other movements, right? It's why you have reproductive justice movements, because the reproductive rights white women wouldn't listen to black women, specifically Black women, who were talking about more than abortion, who were talking about more than Roe versus Wade, who also told those white women, you need to codify Roe versus Wade, and we were ignored. But anyway, so this, it talks about that and how disability justice has 10 principles. The first is working on intersectionality. The 10th is collective liberation. And those 1 through 10 in between, the disability rights community will never work on. I also have a conversation in the book around what it is to work in D.C. and what that work looks like, mm-hmm. and how the fact that disability rights community centers white people and white people issues is harmful to Black people's policy issues and concerns. And I'll come back to that in a minute. And then I just also want people to know, woven throughout the book is also a conversation of hope and how we can make changes and how, you know, I tell the story of this is what happens, but this is how we can make change. I also have a glossary in my introduction, which is really unusual, and I've been hearing from a lot of critics who are like, I really enjoyed the glossary, and thank you for that. It is not an academic glossary. It is a social justice glossary. It is words that have come from our community and been distorted by white folks, and used in ways we don't want them used. You know, like using the term pro-Black and understanding that you can be anti-racist, and I want you to be anti-racist, but I need you to be anti-racist and pro-Black, which means you're going to center Black people in the work that you're doing. And it is very interesting to see, as we are now seeing, and we keep telling people, it is Black women who will move things. It is a Black community who's going to get things done. And so that's there. But I'll real quick go back to the policy question. And people always say this, what does that mean? So let me say I'll do education policy, education equity. In education, the number one concern that people, communities, families have put forward to many of us, and researchers have shown this, is the fact of safety for their children in school. And safety for Black families does not mean law enforcement, does not mean the pushing forward SROs, which are school resource officers, which is law enforcement. They actually want those people out of the schools. But when you censor white families, and this is what disability rights community does, they don't engage in that conversation. They don't engage in the school-to-prison pipeline conversation. They don't engage in ending corporal punishment conversation. Why? Because those concerns are about Black and brown disabled students. So they really want to, they have a concern around, of course, inclusion of students in schools. We are all for that. They have a conversation around ending the harmful practice of restraint and seclusion, which still happens in this country. And I discuss that in the book, and that's fine. But when it comes to issues and concerns of Black and brown families, even feeding their children in school, right, having school lunch, free school lunches, that's not part of their education policy agenda, and they don't want it to be. And so I discuss that in the book. And then finally, I discuss, which is a very unique thing to this community. I have worked around many communities, as you know, Barbara, as an ally, right? Like, I'm not queer or gay, but I work with the LGBTQ queer community, non-binary community a lot. And I have never found this in this work except in the disability rights community. And what they do is called a comparative suffering. And I define that in the glossary so you'll know what that is. And let me just give you one example, and it's a horrible one. The number one issue for disabled folks is getting people out of institutions, right? We believe in, we're abolitionists, and to say there should be no institutions that put anybody, especially Black bodies, in bondage. And so when they do this, they'll get people out. They call themselves the Disability Rights Underground Railroad. And they compare themselves to the actual Underground Railroad and say that they are the Harriet Tubmans of this movement. And you are hearing me right. Your radio is not being messed up. This is what they do. And it is so insulting. The first time I heard it, it took me aback. As they say, you give receipts. This is written in an article from May 2008 that they continue to use. And I just literally just heard it 2 weeks ago from a young lady who's doing this work, and she still says we're the Disability Underground Railroad. And so these are the kinds of harmful disrespectful, racist things that, you know, observations they use. There are a couple of others that I discuss in the book, and you'll find them. But the first thing I told them was, black women going to get you. You can't talk about Harriet Tubman like this. And there is, you know, they keep saying there's a comparison, you know, of our suffering. And that is not true. Let me be clear. Nursing homes can be horrible, but they were not people who were enslaved. And you are not Harriet Tubman. And so those are the things that I have to deal with. I had to deal with. Many of us who do this work have to deal with. And so I talk about this in the book.
Right. And I love, you know, you're talking about the appropriation of our struggle and the misappropriation of it and the misalignments and all of those, you know, horrific things. You know, I wanted to go back to where we were talking about the impact of this disability rights community. One, you've made some really amazing points in your book. One is that the majority of these leaders aren't even disabled. I said, what?
The rest.
And I said, who, what, how? You know, they're not even, it's not just that they're white and that they have, you know, all the prejudices that come and don't even challenge themselves, but they're not even disabled. You know, how did this whole movement, you know, allow itself to be constructed in such a non-representative manner? And then you talk about what I call the Iron Curtain. You know, people call it glass ceilings, steel curtain, steel, you know, the steel ceiling. But I call it the Iron Curtain of just trying to break through to get in, to get people to in these leaderships to move over and, you know, and to accept, you know, new blood, to accept more diverse members, to have, you know, a sense of that. And you say, no, there's no intention. This is very intentional, the structure that we see. Talk about that some more.
Yeah, sure. Well, exactly. It is very intentional, and I love your Iron Curtain comparison. And let me say this. You talked about it just a bit. It comes from the Ugly Laws, which are laws that were created in, they were created in 1865. If you've never heard about them, I write about them in the book, but you can also Google the Ugly Laws. And basically what they said is that, you know, if you have a disability, you can't be in public spaces. You couldn't be going to school, you couldn't go to the playground, you couldn't go to the grocery store, right? You just, you kept them inside. And then in the quote-unquote, the racism and ableism New Deal that FDR did, he codified that with Social Security and said, you know what? Let's put these people in institutions. And they started, that's where institutionalizing disabled folks came from. So I say all that to say, that is why you have this feeling, you know, even with Gus Waltz, when they said he shouldn't be in that space, that's what Ann Coulter was bringing up, right? Right. It's saying the Ugly Laws is that this person shouldn't be in public. So let's start from there. So when you have this concept of disabled people are not supposed to be in my space, they're not supposed to be, quote unquote, at my level, and you start organizations, that's what happened. A lot of these white disability rights organizations were started mostly by parents who had disabled children, who had good intentions, right? Because like I said, when you had a child and they were born with, let's say, Down syndrome, because that's something you can really see at birth, they put them in an institution. And in the 1970s, mid-70s is when a group of specifically white women mothers said, nope, you're not going to do that to my child. And started having these comments. That's where you get the IDEA, the Individuals with Disability Education Act, that said these children deserve to have education. That started some civil rights for disabled people. And then it moved into the movement of creating the Americans with Disabilities Act. Well, at the forefront of that work were white men and white able-bodied men, cisgender men and women, and specifically mostly upper middle class wealthy folks who led this fight. Now, don't get me wrong. There are, you know, of course, what they call grassroots and in the streets groups like ADAPT, and you've seen them before. They took over Mitch McConnell's office to fight for the ACA. But even that, you still see, right, white people leading that. And so they're still there. It's the ADA just celebrating the 34th anniversary, July 26th of this year. And yet you still have these white folks, specifically white, non-disabled, cisgendered, That's another thing you need to understand. The homophobia within the disability community is really bad. People running these things. And so let me say this again. It's not just the disability rights. So you will see this. Like, we've been talking, right, in housing justice and housing movement. We keep seeing, you know, and I talk about this, the New World Order, I define it,